Welcome back to the Extension Experience Podcast. I'm Dana Zook. We have come to December in the calendar, and I'm joined by Dr. Daryl Peel for a holiday wrap-up of the beef markets. Welcome, Daryl.
It's good to be back again.
Yes. My title here says Outlook, Beef Cycle, Industry Craziness, and Holiday Shenanigans. So who knows where we'll go today, but we're going to try to
have some fun.
Yeah, we're going to have a little bit of fun. So, Daryl, what have you been up to in the last month?
It's been a busy fall. Obviously, the end of the year is outlook season, so Everybody wants outlook for next year, and maybe more so this year just because of the markets we're in. They're pretty unique. And so I've done a lot of short articles, outlook articles, some meetings, a lot of web-based stuff. I haven't really been traveling all that much, relatively speaking. I mean, less than usual for me.
Not nationally as much, maybe.
Not as much here lately. But yeah, it's been busy. The markets are just obviously a lot of attention on the markets right now because we're pretty much at record levels.
It's crazy. Okay. So we talked back in August a little bit about heifer expansion in the beef cycle. So let's touch on that real quick before we dive into the current stuff. So how have things changed since then? Because we were kind of feeling like we didn't know what was going to happen with expansion. Where are we at?
You know, thought we might see some indications of heifer retention by the end of the year. Absolutely none so far. You know, I mean, all we've got to go on in the short run is the slaughter data, which has got a lag in it, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time slaughter goes down, it means that people made decisions 6 or 8 months ago not to place those heifers. So we could be holding a few heifers here at the end of the year. I don't really think so. When you look at the feeder cattle auction volumes, there's not much indication to me that we're holding back a lot of heifers at this point. So it looks to me like we're going to finish out 2024 with no real start to numbers. I think the beef cow herd got smaller in 2024. So I think the January 1 numbers will show that we are starting 2025 smaller than we were. And then we start over with this same set of questions for next year. Still looking for a bottom, if you will.
So that's what I was thinking you would say. Yeah, things haven't changed. We've been at several OQBN markets, sales. Yep. I feel like we didn't see a lot of replacement heifer worthy sell. I think they were all just selling as calves.
They're feeder cattle. And obviously, the other part of it that we do see a little more timely than the slaughter, which comes after we feed them, but going into the feedlot, you look at placements haven't come down. Feedlots have been able to hold their inventories. Again, at some point in time, if we, and I say if, it's really, I think, when we start saving heifers and we do actually try to rebuild this industry, then that feedlot inventory has to come down.
Right.
We because the calf crop's been getting smaller for about 6 years, and yet feedlots for the last year been able to hold the inventory steady on a year-over-year basis for about 14 months now. A large part of it's because we're still feeding heifers. The other part of it, of course, is that we've slowed down the rate of turnover in the feedlots by extending days on feed. And so less cattle, you can still keep the feedlot full. I don't know if I did this in August, but I'll do it again.
Yeah.
I tell everybody, feedlot is like a water tank.
Okay.
Right? So you got a pipe coming in, that's placements. You got a pipe going out, that's marketings.
Okay.
And even if there's less water coming in the placements pipe, if you slow down the rate of outflow, you can hold the level of the tank full when there's less water going through the whole system. And that's exactly what we've been doing with the feedlots for the last years, is kind of moving sideways on feedlot inventories, but there's actually less cattle going through the system at this point.
So how long can we do that?
Well, we've already done it probably a year longer than I really thought we would.
Crazy.
But there has to be an end to it. I mean, I think feedlots are increasingly sort of out of runway to be able to do that. And we will see these feedlot inventories come down. So I'm going to say sometime in this next year. I thought it would start this year. But again, because we're still feeding heifers largely, we haven't seen them forced to drop that yet.
Okay, so now we're on the calf topic. So light calves have gotten really expensive, seems like.
Absolutely. Following, and you know, after Thanksgiving, these feeder cattle markets just really exploded. And not just in Oklahoma, but around the country.
Okay.
And it's a national thing. And I think it's both supply and demand. I mean, obviously, the rain we got in November, we are going to have some late wheat pasture in the southern plains. But, you know, I suspect a lot of people who were going to graze wheat probably already had those calves that they had bought. There was probably some additional buying, but I don't think the bulk of it was that. But if anything, that was a positive to demand. But what I'm hearing is around the country, again, numbers are fairly tight. And even up north in the northern plains, there's a lot of talk about the fact that the Canadians are coming down buying feeder cattle in Montana and North Dakota to take back and place them in feedlots in Canada because they're short in numbers. And so all of that adds up to a lot of demand combined with a tight supply, and you get the kind of feeder cattle prices that we've seen.
Yeah, it seems like we just don't see as many little light calves in the sales. Of course, I'm not there every week or anything, but it probably there's just a high demand. They're just taken up, or they're just bigger when they're weaned.
I don't think there's many of them. I mean, you know, the numbers just aren't there. In Oklahoma, at least, the drought that we had through the summer and into the fall, really through October, really caused us to have kind of an early fall run. So we saw bigger volumes in September and October. And then they started to drop a little bit in November, although I've been surprised with these really high markets the last couple of weeks that we've seen in the first part of December. The volumes have actually been pretty good. We're finding lots of cattle to sell and take advantage of these markets. And so I think we're really cleaning things out at this point.
So wheat pasture is looking good. I feel like I've traveled the world in December since Thanksgiving. And so recording this, whatever today is, Daryl, is it the 13th or 14th? And Friday the 13th, oh my goodness. Well, now you hear it, listeners, we're recording on Friday the 13th. And I feel like there's pockets of good wheat pasture. And where it is, there's calves out there. They were just ready to put them out there. But I think you're right. I think they bought them. They had them purchased because I can't imagine buying an expensive, really light calf and making any money on it.
You know, if you look at the budgets right now, and you and I were doing this the other day, right? So if you take a, you know, a 4-weight calf right now, they're going to be 350 plus or minus, maybe 370 or 80. If you're a state or two north of here, they're going to be $4 or better.
Yeah.
And what's happened in this fall is the lightweight cattle have gone up way more than the bigger feeder cattle. So you get a bigger rollback in that price based on today's market. And that makes the stocker budgets look pretty tough. And that's kind of what you expect in general in this kind of a market, is that margin operations don't work very well when cattle numbers are tight and prices are high.
Yeah.
Because the price increases all start at the bottom and work their way up the system. So stocker margins are pretty tight. Feedlot margins are going to get tighter. They've been relatively tight, but they'll get tighter. And of course, packer margins have been horrible for many months now and will continue to be for the foreseeable future. And at some point, even retail margins will probably feel some of this squeeze because, you know, the cattle prices are going up more and faster than beef prices, even though beef prices are remarkably good.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've heard some very happy producers, and I've heard some producers to say, what am I going to do? So, okay. So we talked a little about prices, but what are some things going on outside, I guess not outside the beef industry, but some other outside forces that have been impacting beef and protein markets?
Well, you know, probably the biggest thing that happened right before Thanksgiving, of course, was the discovery of a case of New World screwworm in southern Mexico. And that led to an immediate closure of the border between the U.S. and Mexico as far as any livestock crossing from Mexico into the U.S. So, you know, and the screwworm probably doesn't represent, I mean, as long as we stay on top of it and control it, probably not a tremendous threat. It's a big issue if it gets here, and we sure don't want to go back to that. We spent millions and millions of dollars 50, 60 years ago to eradicate it. And we've continued to spend millions of dollars every year to contain it and make sure we don't get it back. We've got a little slip up here in terms of it kind of getting away. But as long as we get that under control, not a major issue long term, but it means that we're going to get a couple hundred thousand head less Mexican cattle here right at the end of the year than we would have gotten. And that's probably going to push them off to next year as long as the border opens back up. And it probably will by January, then those cattle they'll go ahead and come in.
Yeah.
And many of them would have been fairly lightweight coming in anyway. They would have come up here into a stocker or backgrounding program. They're now doing the stocker or backgrounding program in Mexico, waiting until such time as they can come up here. And so we'll probably get them in any event, but just a little bit later.
Yeah. Okay. What about this avian flu business? I mean, that's not... It's sort of related, you know, sort of not. But
well, you know, we got to pay attention to all of these issues, even though it's not a direct impact on beef markets per se. Obviously, the dairy industry has struggled a lot with HPA. And of course, in terms of Oklahoma, we have now found, as at this point in time, two cases in commercial flocks.
Yes.
So there's been some depopulation of poultry. And there are some trade implications, potentially, that can impact sort of where Oklahoma-based poultry production and those products can go. So it's an issue for the industry, for that industry, for the poultry industry. It's not really an overall meat or protein complex issue. We're not losing enough birds to really affect overall production. Like I said, there are some trade impacts, but probably not a major deal. But again, we can't really afford to ignore it because it gets into dairy cattle, causes some loss of production there. Somebody asked me the other day, why don't we ever see this in beef cattle? And the answer is we're really not looking for it.
Yeah.
And it's mild enough in cattle in most cases that we probably wouldn't see it unless we were actively looking for it. Mm-hmm. So we may well have had it in some cases, but, you know, it's not a big issue. But influenza is a very, very rapidly evolving disease. And so it could continue to evolve and turn into a bigger issue at some point.
Well, in dairy cattle, we're monitoring their health and wellness and milking them every day. And so that's really easy to figure that out.
That's why you see it there. Exactly. Yeah. You notice the loss of production because milk production is a day-to-day thing. Plus, you're just around those animals and handling them more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in a feedlot situation, I don't think you'd really probably be able to detect any loss of production if it were there. And so, again, we're just not seeing that much impact directly on the beef side at this point.
So what else? Other things that might be throwing things off, or just the high prices are just crazy?
Well, you know, it's kind of all of these things come together. But underneath it all is just the fact that we're at these multi-decade lows in cattle inventories and still getting smaller, it appears, at this point. So when we talk about how low the beef cow herd was, the lowest since 1961, that was January of 2024. Everything I've got suggests it's going to be a little smaller yet in 2025. And when you look at the number of replacement heifers that we had in the pipeline in 2024, there's not really enough of them to do more than maybe at best stabilize the herd in 2025, with probably at least 50-50 odds that we continue to get smaller in 2025. It may depend on the drought, or it very likely will depend on drought conditions as much as anything, but it's just not clear that we're done getting smaller, even though we're the smallest we've been in many, many years.
Yeah, so interesting. We're in uncharted waters, right, Daryl?
We really are. We really are.
So I've got holiday nonsense written on here.
Are all holidays nonsense?
They are, sure. They are nonsense. They're craziness. Now, we're just going to switch gears a little bit here because we could beat the herd expansion thing until it's dead on its feet. So I got on the NCBA website and they had a holiday report, an eating report, beef demand. So give us your kind of synopsis on beef demand here, Daryl. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing. Do you feel like we've lost the people that only buy beef when it's cheaper, that we've already lost all those people, so it's not going to change from here on out?
You know, I've been monitoring for many months trying to find evidence of either loss of beef demand or what we call trading down. So people that, you know, kind of give up on the really expensive middle meats and maybe move to more value-based products. And honestly, I can't find much of any of that. The latest retail beef prices that came out were still up year over year. On average, the reported retail beef prices are up almost 6%. And if you look at the ratio of beef to broiler or pork prices, they're still at virtually record levels. So if consumers wanted to turn away from beef, there's plenty of ways they could do that, I think. There's plenty of product, and the prices would be more favorable. We just don't see it.
Yeah.
And so beef demand appears to be quite robust. Now, there have been some indications that food service beef demand maybe weakened slightly in 2024. And certainly the prices have gone up faster through the food service, the restaurant side, if you will, compared to retail grocery. But they're all at record levels, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I monitor a bunch of wholesale cuts to try to look at these trade-offs. And do we see any changes in middle meats and end meat relationships and that kind of thing? Can't really find much of anything. And if you look at, like, the rib primal, for example, we had a very strong seasonal increase in November, you know, October into November, which is typical with people that are treating, you know, prime rib as the protein of choice
the centerpiece
for Christmas dinner, New Year's, whatever. that holiday demand. And from a wholesale level, it usually starts in October, November. And we had a very strong increase in those prices. So just no indication that beef isn't still what's for dinner. And maybe particularly it's what's for holiday dinner.
That's right. Okay, so this is what I found. So I did a little, not a lot of sleuthing, but a little bit. So NCBA's website talked about consumer preference for the holidays. And so the turkey was, of course, the Thanksgiving preference. Now,
right.
Whether they did that on the when they did that with the grocery store. But it says in Christmas time, beef is the choice, the popular choice for Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
So it must be prime rib.
Yeah.
The rib primal, which is not always prime rib, right? I've had the rib roast that's not necessarily
the rib roll. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. So that's what they said.
In and of itself doesn't mean it's prime, but but prime rib is, it is very popular.
It's the most tender, should be the most tender part of the beef animal.
Yeah, it is. It's
tender.
If it's done right.
If it's done right. That's hard.
It is. And that's why a lot of people don't try to do it at home. But it's also kind of hard to find restaurants that do it well.
Yes.
There's a lot of places that don't necessarily do it well. You know, as a general rule, when you get prime rib in a restaurant on an ongoing basis, they didn't cook it there.
Yeah, that's right.
So you really got to find a place that kind of specializes in it, that does it and does it well.
Mm-hmm. So what's your favorite? So what's your favorite beef? Do you do beef at Christmas time?
We do a little of everything.
Yeah, so, we were talking about that earlier. Did some Mexican for Thanksgiving, sort of.
We were talking about that. Actually, my family, and this is more of a Christmas Eve thing, our get together before we, and we usually do our packages, the bulk of them at least, on Christmas Eve.
Okay.
But for years and years, we've done fondue.
Oh, fun.
And so that's meat fondue or cheese fondue, and then maybe a dessert fondue, a pot of chocolate sauce, and you can dip all kinds of
delicious.
And it's fun. It's a slower meal. It's a way to slow down the kids because they're always antsy to get to the packages and
stuff.
Yes, so
that's true.
This makes it a little bit longer meal so they don't just wolf down their food and be standing around begging to get
done.
To the packages. And so we've done that for a long time
Fun.
Our family, and it's kind of a carryover from the popular fondue days, which was more 70s and 80s, I suppose, but it is a lot of fun.
So is it like broth or is it oil? Like,
we generally did oil based.
Okay, like
so oil fries. And you could have either cut up bits of steak or meatballs and cook those in that, and then you got a cheese fondue and sometimes a couple different kinds of that, and you can dip French bread or broccoli, or celery pieces or whatever and cheese sauce. And then, after that's all done, and then you get the chocolate fondue out and you've got marshmallows and pineapple and strawberries.
How delicious. I want to do
cake.
This. Yeah.
And so, it's pretty good stuff.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Like a non-traditional type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just cut up a bunch of stuff.
It is, yeah. If you don't like it, it's your fault. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
And if you don't like how it's cooked, it's your fault, right?
That's right.
Now, it's always a little tricky with little kids when you got pots of hot oil. And so, you got to be a little careful with that stuff. But it's worth it. It's worth the effort.
We'll have to try that sometime.
Yeah.
That sounds fun. My mother and father-in-law always do like either tenderloin or some sort of rib roast for both of the big holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, which it's always delicious. And I usually pass the dessert and just have another
slice
of tenderloin. But when I was growing up, we were hog farmers. We had pigs all the time. And so we ate a lot of pork.
Yep.
Pork loin was always a really good thing. Today's pork loin is not the pork loin of the past.
Pretty good, but I know what you're saying. The animals are very different. The beef animals are a lot different. Maybe not as much in flavor, although you could make that argument too, I suppose. But one of the things I was going to mention, and this is kind of an aside, but it's a function of the industry we're in. You know, carcass weights in the beef industry have gone up for 70 years.
Yes.
If you go back to about 1960, the average increase in steer carcass weights has been about 4.5 pounds a year. But at times it's accelerated faster than that. That's the average over a long period of time. And for about 30 years, I predicted they wouldn't keep getting bigger, and they did. So I got tired of being wrong, so I quit predicting that. We keep finding ways, both genetically and with technology, to get these animals bigger. And the reason I started telling that is because we started hearing probably 10 or 12, maybe 15 years ago, that these prime rib roasters for the holidays, that's a fixed size.
It's huge.
Thing. Those are big things, but the ribs were getting so big that they wouldn't fit in there. And so we were hearing stories about how those guys were specking heifer carcasses, heifer ribs,
okay,
because they were smaller than the steers. Well, that was 10 years ago. Now the heifer carcasses are as big as the steers were 10 or 12 years ago. So what do you do now? And I don't know what's, you know, whether they've had to make changes. You know, as these muscles in the beef animal have gotten bigger, by and large, consumers haven't been asking for bigger steaks for about 20 years.
Yeah.
So we're having to do more and more kind of creative fabrication. Mm-hmm. And so, as you well know, a lot of times now when you order a ribeye steak, it's actually the center cut, mm-hmm, where they've taken off the spinalis muscle, which is the most tender.
Delicious.
Yes. You know, it's not
and
real.
And flavorful.
And that gets taken off and you do something else.
Yeah, what
with
are they
it.
Doing with it? And, I want that instead.
Exactly. And so, you know, again, we're having to do my... About probably 15 years ago, I used to joke that when we started having to market ribeye nuggets, we probably had gone too far in this industry. And effectively, that's what we're doing now in some sense. So I was wrong. We are doing it, and there's no real sign that it's letting up at this point. So,
well, I guess if it brings more value to a beef carcass, whatever, and, market those ribeye nuggets.
It's still about pounds at the end of the day. I mean, quality matters, and obviously we enjoy high quality and stuff, but pounds is what drives the train still. Mm-hmm. And so... Yeah, so we're still making them bigger.
That's crazy. Very good. Well, this has been an excellent conversation, Daryl. Thanks for joining me today. And listeners, thanks so much for joining me through the whole year. This isn't, like I told Daryl, this podcast doesn't make a big splash, but we do enjoy it. I do enjoy it. And so I appreciate you listening. It really has been fun. So Merry Christmas to all. Merry Christmas, Daryl.
Merry Christmas to you as well. Absolutely. Yeah.
Listeners, have a wonderful week and a happy new year.